everyone, welcome to the Front Church Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. In a moment, I'll be joined by my colleague Mike Neff to discuss an interesting Dover race that saw long green flag runs and Kyle Larson snap a 75 race winless streak. He had to battle lap traffic, as did Martin Truex Jr., Denny Hamlin, and other front runners who were none too pleased with Joey Logano, who was racing them hard more than 20 laps down. We'll talk proper lap traffic etiquette and also the mechanical failures that three playoff cars had. But before we get started, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the Front Stretch Podcast on Apple Podcasts, as those ratings help us out tremendously. Now let's talk Dover with Neff. All right, Neff, Kyle Larson victorious in Dover over the weekend. We were talking offline about this. Honestly, not that much of an entertaining race, very hard to pass. We knew that coming in, especially based off the spring race, but we were hoping with the advancements of this package and, you know, more time throughout the season that maybe it'd be a better race. But clean air is king, Neff, and Kyle Larson took advantage of that.
That's just it. A turd is a turd. And no matter how much you polish a turd, sometimes it's still a turd. And that's what we had. I mean, I'm with you. I thought that having some races under the belt and figuring out what this package really wants and needs, we would see a better race when we got there this time. But, I mean, for intents and purposes, I thought Martin Truex probably had the best car on the track. And his pit crew, the guy changing the rear tires, stumbled coming around the car on their last pit stop. And, you know, it cost him a half a second, maybe three quarters of a second. And that was enough for them to lose four or five positions. And he was in fifth, and you're like, okay, he's in fifth. He's going to work his way back to the front. And he just couldn't move. And it was amazing to me how you could not pass at all when there were multiple grooves. That's the part that, you know, we've seen that. I'm trying to remember when it was at Casey Kane. I mean, it was pre-Larson when Casey Kane went up there and ran the rim and won years ago. And since that point in time, we've had multiple racing grooves up there. And they cleaned the middle and upper groove off relatively early in the race. But it didn't matter. No matter where you went, you just couldn't make time. And I know somebody somewhere in the big glass tower in Daytona thinks this package is the answer to everything. But man alive, it was god-awful Sunday.
Yeah, I think Sunday was kind of like, that was the that's what we thought we were going to get at the beginning of the year when we saw this package play out for the first few races. And, you know, I don't think we ever thought it'd be this bad. And obviously NASCAR, you know, officials from NASCAR thinks it's going to be better or thinks it would have progressed by now. But with as much time that's gone by, the teams are going to just, you know, fine tune on their stuff and the aero and all the stuff that goes into this package. And I mean, that was a pretty, in my opinion, bad race.
Anything, we've gotten more parity. I mean, we had parity to begin with the no ride height rule, and these cars are running closer lap times than ever before. And now that these guys have tweaked on it some, it's even less differentiation than there used to be. You were kind of hoping there was going to be a little bit more, but there's not. And they're just, everybody's running the exact same speeds almost.
Yeah, and you know, there's been drivers that have been critical of it all year, like Kyle Busch. That his first epic run of the year, really, was the first Dover race when he couldn't pass. Didn't go on any kind of time rants over the weekend after the race this weekend. He was one of the ones that was able to race through the traffic, but, you know, it was regulated to sixth. And that's, honestly, from where he was in practice, he says that's an improvement. So, but when you do have drivers that, you know, haven't really spoken up about this package, you know, for example, Clint Bowyer, after the race, he said it was one of the most boring races he feels like he's ever been in NASCAR. I mean, that says a lot for someone that's been around for 15 years. Jimmy Johnson taking to Twitter. I'm sure this didn't make the NASCAR brass happy. He says, "I remember a day when you could pass with a faster car. That was not today. All in all, a strong weekend with a few areas to dial in." I mean, Jimmy had a good car over the weekend, too, and he was just fifth to eighth
all day. I picked him last week, but watching practice and watching qualifying, you thought that he seriously had a shot at winning, and you expect that from him at Dover. and he went into the race, and the race fired off, and it looked like he might be in contention, and he just never went anywhere. And it was kind of actually kind of funny that Mike Wheeler, the crew chief for Matt DiBenedetto, late in the race, told him that if he could pass Jimmy Johnson, he'd give him $20. And on Twitter, sometime on Sunday, I saw he actually posted a snapshot of his PayPal receipt showing that he did send the $20 to DiBenedetto because he did actually make the pass on Johnson. But it just, I mean, it's one thing for passing to be difficult, and I think that makes racing enjoyable to watch when guys have to work to get by each other, which is why Richmond used to be one of my favorite tracks because it would take 10 or 12 or 15 laps to make a pass. But this thing, Sunday, it didn't matter. You never made the pass. You just sat there and tried different lines and tried different spots. And unless somebody seriously had an aero issue where they lost the nose of the car significantly, you didn't get by him. And it was just terrible.
Yeah, and, you know, this package, particularly at Dover, I mean, you're so much faster than before. Denny Hamlin set a new track record in qualifying on Saturday. Granted, that's one car, you know, single car runs, but if you've ever been to the Dover International Speedway's press box, it's like right kind of equidistant with the racetrack, a little bit over it, but not higher than the catch fence. You can really get the sensation of speed. You can feel it. You can see it from the press box at Dover. So these guys are hauling ass, and you can really tell from there. But I say that because they're so, I mean, this aero, there was no cautions, Neff. There was really no cautions. There was two stage breaks. That's it. These cars are so, they're not out of control anymore. And we've talked about that all year. They're so close to the racetrack, which you've said thousands probably of times on this podcast, how they need to be up a little bit, kind of like the Roval. And granted, that's a road course. But, man, this was just, I don't know. This was a bad race. And doesn't, you know, and for the Cup Series, and I heard this on NBC did a podcast with Dale Jarrett and Nate Ryan. They posted Tuesday morning. And you get one shot in NASCAR. You know, the NFL is like 16 games per week. You get one shot at the top level in NASCAR. And if you're selling this, I mean, I'm not sold.
Yeah, I went back through and looked at average times or average speeds or pole speeds for the last, I don't know, dozen years. And they were 9 miles an hour faster for the most part this year than they were in the past. And it just, and you're using half the horsepower. I mean, you're stuck to the ground so hard that and with that kind of banking, you're not lifted. I mean, in all honesty, I think the thing that we're at now, if we're going to stick with this package, is we need to put them on tires that are like 8 inches wide. Something that's going to cause them to have to drive the car. Because right now, they're basically running slot cars. I mean, these things are so stuck that they just almost never get out of shape. Nobody can spin. And try as Jeff Burton does to tell us that these things are hard to drive, they're just not.
Yeah, and they might be at some of the tracks, but not Dover.
Not Dover.
Yeah. You know, back in the day, like, I don't know, even just five years ago, you would think that Dover has the potential, even 3 years ago, Dover has the potential to be a crazy race. And it hasn't been that way recently, especially this year. You know, there's only, what, eight cars on the lead lap at the end of this race. In the spring, I think there was 10, and Truex won by 9 seconds. So, I don't know, comparing the races, I would say this one maybe was a little better, but then you could say that's wrong because both Truex and Bowman came from the back in the spring to finish first and second. So, I don't know what the conclusion that we could do, you know, come up with for this race was.
Yeah, you used to have big ones.
Yeah.
At Dover, you know, and the whole front stretch would all be all the way down the inside wall because it was self-cleaning. You'd have 10 or 12 cars all wadded up. And nobody's out of shape. And it's just it's just incredibly frustrating.
And just look how much clean air mattered. I mean, Denny Hamlin led 218 laps, or the first 228 laps, which is the most laps he's led in 9 years in a single race. But, you know, you look at that, he led the first 11 laps, then he hit lap traffic, which we'll talk about. Larson got by for a lap, Hamlin got right back by, led the next 63 laps, then there's a pit cycle, Then Hamlin got back out front and led 101 straight laps. And then Larson got by for a couple laps, and then Hamlin got back by through pit cycle. And so then lap traffic comes towards the end of the stage, which, like I said, we'll get into. And Martin Truex Jr. and Denny Hamlin have a pretty good battle. But then Larson ends the race with a 73-lap stint to lead, you know, after a pit cycle, after he led just 78 and given up the lead for six laps to Paul Menard. So, I don't know. This is frustrating because you want so much more out of racing, but especially Dover, the Monster Mile. I mean, the Monster Mile was tame at best.
Yeah, absolutely. It actually harkens back to, and Jim Utter used to always laugh about this as one of the greatest headlines ever, but when they used the restrictor plates at New Hampshire and Jeff Burton led every lap, he said that the headline in Pools column was "The Magic Mile Made Racing Disappear." And in all honesty, that's what happened this weekend. The Monster, it was neutered. I mean, there was no monster to it.
No, not at all. I mean, in terms of, you know, mechanical failures, I guess a little bit, but I don't know. The racing was pretty bad. But enough. Kyle Larson did get the victory, ending a 75 race winless streak. Advances to the round of eight for the first time in his career. This 42 teams, it's been hot for a little bit now, but it's getting hot at the right time.
Yeah, I mean, I have felt all season like Chip Ganassi Racing was better just because Kurt Busch was there. Right. I think that has added to that organization. I think that has taken them up a notch. And in all honesty, I felt like for at least the first half of the year, if not more, Kyle Larson was kind of pushing it and actually kind of taking chances or going further than he needed to because of the ability that Kurt was showing. And the fact that, you know, Larson had been the top dog at Ganassi for a while, and now all of a sudden Kurt was outperforming him. And I think that kind of lit a fire under this 42 team, and they've kind of stepped up their game. And now for them, it all seems to have kind of worked itself together here in the last 8 to 10 races. And I feel like they're kind of hitting their stride at the right time. We've said it for a long time that if you get Cole Custer or Kyle Larson at Miami Homestead with a shot for the championship, you're in trouble. And right now I feel like the Larson has kind of thrown down the gauntlet a little bit that they're good. And if he can manage to do something over the last couple races in the round of eight, you'll be in trouble at Homestead if Larson is in the final four.
Yeah, we've said that for years. And, I mean, if we remember the start of the year, Larson had atrocious. Between Texas and Charlotte, seven races, he had four DNFs. One was on his hood at Talladega, which we go to this weekend. Wrecked out at Richmond, blew a couple tires there. Wrecked out at Texas as well, as he did in Charlotte. And then he goes through the summer. He starts getting top tens more consistently. Goes to Loudon, crashes in practice. Crashes in the race, really for no reason, and he took the blame for it then, for just making a bonsai move on Alex Bowman that really had no, you know, no gain at the time. Then the next week, I was here for this at Pocono, he crashes in opening practice, like the first couple of minutes he was out on the track. Goes to a backup car, finishes fifth. And that, I feel like that kind of, that incident matured him quite a bit, because if you look at Pocono on, he's got two finishes outside the top 10 in the past 10 races. A worse finish of eighth in those, you know, those eight top tens. And then at Indy, he wrecked out while he was leading or up there battling for the lead. He led 22 laps at Indy. And then at the Roval, he won a stage and then, you know, was held the lap and could never get that position back, track position. So, it's Larson, he's dangerous, man. And he's, I think, like you said, Kurt helped this team quite a bit, Ganassi as a whole. And now Larson's getting hot at the right time, and I mean, he's through to the next round. Now, the next round you look at it, Martinsville, he hates Martinsville. Never runs well there, admittedly so. Texas, like I said, he crashed out earlier this year, but he's decent at. And then Phoenix, he's pretty good at. So, Neff, it's realistic he could get to Homestead.
Oh, no doubt about it. We've seen him at ISM. I mean, he's run decently there. Remember the famous Newman taking him out? I mean, it just, you expect him to rise to the top of a track like that where you're kind of feeling around and finding lanes and going. So I would, I mean, you never know. Anything can happen in these deals, but I feel like he's got as good a shot as anybody at winning over those last three races, even though, as you said, he hates Martinsville. But we've seen other guys that hate Martinsville that have the light bulb go on and figure it out and then go on a tear. So if he figures it out, he very well could go win at Martinsville and that put him in. But as long as he keeps it close, he's going to have a shot. And if he makes it to Homestead with a shot, everybody else is in trouble.
Yeah, and honestly, for the sport, I know although it wasn't a good race at Dover, but I think it's a good, you know, a pretty popular winner. And Larson, I mean, he needed this. Like I said, 75 races without a win. And we all think, and we probably know that Larson's a generational talent. Not just in NASCAR, obviously anything he drives in, he's really good at. And he's struggled a bit at this NASCAR stuff. 9 second place finishes since his last win, so it's not like he's been out to lunch. But at the beginning of this year, he's as far down as 21st in points heading into the first Dover race. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see if they can keep this up. And, you know, really, they go to Talladega with a stress-free race, just go after the win, which he's I know he doesn't have the finishes, but he is a decent super speeder racer. So, it'll be fun to watch, for sure.
I think if he's a smart man, he will find those Penske cars and the Wood Brothers car and stick with them. Because the way those guys have been running, they know that they're in trouble. And I really feel like at Talladega, you're going to see those guys all try to get nose to tail and not let go.
Just like last year with Stuart Haas.
Yep. And I think that if they're together, I think they can move forward. And he'd be a smart man to just tuck in with them and then figure out what happens when you get to the end.
Yeah, I guess the only problem with that is, I guess we can get into this, is the manufacturer alliance that is going to happen this week. And we've seen really all year between really Ford and Chevy, because Toyota only has 5 or 6 drivers that they'll put out there, or cars. So just in numbers, they're going to be behind. And honestly, with the point, I guess, gap that Truex, Hamlin, and Kyle have, I would imagine they're going to ride out in the back until the end. Because, I mean, yes, they'll gain points, but also, Truex is over a race ahead of the cutoff, and there's only 2 races to go. So there's a good shot that a catastrophe would have to happen, and that could happen at Talladega, obviously. So
I was going to say, we don't have to remember that far back to Kyle Busch getting knocked out and going from championship favorite to out of the playoffs at Talladega.
Correct. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to watch this weekend in that manufacturer alliance, which, honestly, the drivers don't like at all. So, yeah, but you brought up Truex earlier, Neff, and how you thought he had the best car. And I guess this is where we get into lap traffic, because it came up earlier in the race also with Truex and Denny Hamlin. Now, lap traffic towards the end of the race, I think it was William Byron, Clint Bowyer, particularly Bowyer, he was giving Larson hell. And Truex went from 6 seconds back to a little over a second within like 5-6 laps. He lost a ton of time, Larson did. What's your thought on lap traffic? Because like I said, we'll get into the Denny Hamlin, Joey Logano stuff in a little bit. But is there an etiquette, especially when you're racing on the lead lap like Bowyer was?
I was going to say, there's a difference. And I've flagged races in my life, and I actually argued with promoters about it because I have been told in my headset to put out the move over flag to a car that's on the lead lap, and I will not do it. Because if you are on the lead lap, you have every right to race and try to stay on the lead lap. Even if you're 6 laps in, if you're one of these trucks that's way off the pace and you're getting lapped 6 laps into a race, while you're on that lead lap, you still have a right to fight for it. And I would never tell somebody to move over while they're on the lead lap. But once you get off the lead lap, then it's a different story. And that was one of the things and Steve Letarte, I think, mentioned it. It may have been Burton, but I think it was Letarte mentioned it during the race when Larson was struggling to get by some lap traffic and he cleared them. They made the comment that Truex wouldn't have as hard of a time because now those cars were a lap down. And I struggle with that because, and you're not near old enough to remember this, but when John Andretti won at Martinsville in the 43, the last time it won way back, Jeff Burton was dominating that race. And every time he got to a car that was on a lead lap, they would race the hell out of him. And Andretti was 20-something, well, not 20, probably 15 seconds back. I mean, almost a lap down at one point. And he starts gaining on him because these guys are racing Burton so hard. And as soon as Burton would pass him, when Andretti got to him, they would just move over. And so it let Andretti reel Burton all the way in. By the time he got to Burton, Burton had used up his stuff because he had to work so hard to get by these other cars. And Andretti was able to pass him and win the race. So I'm torn on that. When you're just going a lap down, how far back with the lead lap cars do you race? Because it's not really fair to the leader for you to just pull over and let second place go right on by after you race the leader so hard. But at the same time, when you're a lap down, you don't want to impact things. So that gets tough. But as long as somebody's on the lead lap, I got no problem with them racing for all their worth to try and stay on the lead lap. If you're 22 laps down, then we're opening a whole different can of worms.
Yeah, so let's get into this now. I agree with you on the first part as well. But Joe Logano, we mentioned mechanical failures. He had one before the race even started. Very similar to Jimmy Johnson last year at Dover. The difference is Logano's in the playoffs, and he came in 27 points above the cutoff, leaves tied with William Byron for the last spot, and via the tiebreaker, Byron would be in right now. Now, something in the rear end of the car, Logano didn't have any specifics. What would you imagine that was, Neff?
It's hard to say. I know on TV, Letarte was thinking that he had lost the half shaft, but we figured it out that belonged to Reed Sorensen. These cars, I believe, similar to late models, run a locker in the rear end,
right,
so that when you're on the throttle, both axles spin, but when you let go, one can move faster than the other. It works kind of like a differential, but not really. And sometimes you can break the locker springs, and so the one axle won't engage. And I'm feeling like that may have been what was going on, but I may be speaking out of turn here too, because I know the rear end housings are a little different on these cars, but I believe they use that locker technology. So I'm thinking it was something along those lines, because we saw when Logano pulled out of his pit to go to the garage, he was able to spin the right rear tire. But it sounded like he didn't have drive on both wheels. So there was something causing the drive to not hit that left side. So either a locker broke or some kind of a spline or something where the grooves on the axle were not driving the tire. And so they had to replace, from the looks of what it looked like they were showing when they were in the garage, they were replacing most everything that had to do with the left rear side on that car.
Yeah, good insight. And that could just be, because it worked fine in qualifying, and this was an impound race, so they qualified Saturday and then raced Sunday. So something in between that happened, whether it was, I'd imagine, something just didn't get crossed off on the pre-race checklist because it was fine in qualifying. He qualified 16th, I think, 14th. So, you know, not a stellar qualifying lap, and you know, but that shouldn't matter because, you know, you expect to get out there, you expect all four wheels to turn, but when something breaks in the rear and you can't, when you hit the gas down and can't turn, or, you know, wheels aren't going, something's broke. And so he did.
And sometimes parts just do break.
Yeah.
I mean, especially when you're at Dover, the vertical loads on those cars because of the banking are enormous. And it may have stressed something. I mean, ironically, and to just kind of tie in the weekend, when I was at Martinsville this weekend, after qualifying, one of the guys, Greg Moore up there, pulled his car into tech and was pushing the car onto the scales, and the A-arm or the spindle in the right front just broke on the car. I mean, literally while pushing it on the scales. There was no real load. It wasn't like they were racing. And it's just like that could have happened the next day when he was – starting the heat race. It just so happened to give up while they were pushing it in the garage area. So part failures happen at weird times sometimes, and I'm thinking that's what happened here, was that they had something that was just giving up, and somewhere between when they qualified and then when they went out and were doing their pace laps, it officially gave up, and they had to bring it in. Or, you know, it's... Because when did he come in? Like, lap three or something?
No, he came in before the race even started.
Well, that's right. He was before the race. It was Elliott that came in on three or four.
Yeah.
So it may be something that as they rolled off pit lane and they transition up onto banking, that's a little bit of a rough transition, causes the thing to bounce a little funny. That may have been what broke the piece. You never know.
But yeah.
It's crazy that it happens that way. And like you mentioned, it happened at Johnson last year. You know, they go out there, everything was kosher, and they broke a hub right as a race started and basically eliminated him from the playoffs.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, I guess I can speak a little bit from experience. I'm surprised that more parts didn't break or don't break anymore at Dover, because that transition with the banking is unreal. It really feels like a roller coaster. I've never driven around there, but I have taken pace car rides around there in the passenger seat, and it's, I mean, you can feel
it. Yeah, it's like the bottom drops out of the car.
Yeah, you can definitely feel it. So, yeah, I'm surprised more parts don't break. But like you said, that could be like a $5 part, for instance. And we've seen that affect championships before. So, unfortunate stuff for Logano. But that did trigger him to go 22 laps down, like you said, Neff. And he ended up finishing the race 25 laps down. At the end of stage two, it was like 12, 15 laps to go in the stage. Denny Hamlin catches him. It might have even been more than that, but Truex started to catch him, you know, catch Hamlin really, really a lot at that point. He started to gain a ton of ground on him and ended up making a pass on him because Hamlin couldn't get by Logano. And after the race, you know, I talked to both Joey and Denny, and Joey said that every point means something, every lap means something. Because if you look at it, you know, in the end, it didn't make a difference. But Garrett Smithley, who drives for Rick Ware Racing, one of the underfunded cars in the series, finished just two laps ahead of Logano. So Joey made up 23 laps on Garrett Smithley. And ultimately, you know, that is another point. Like I said, he is tied with William Byron. So it would have made a difference had he caught him. However, he didn't. And he raced the hell out of Denny Hamlin. Wouldn't let Hamlin pass. And Paul Menard, we talked about this offline too. He was right there as well. But it almost looked like he didn't have a place to go. So he just couldn't find a line to let the leaders by. And he was on Louis Lap. But as far as Logano, Neff, I'm curious to get your take, because like you said, there is a difference between racing the leader when you're on lead lap still and then 25 laps back or 22 at the time.
So Logano has choices, you know, he's 20, whatever laps down. And I understand that he's racing for a championship and every little bit counts. We got to this point where we don't give but one point at the back of the field to kind of discourage people from doing that kind of thing. But unfortunately, he chose to make that run because he thought if he could get to Smithley, he might pick up a point. And we've seen where a point can make a difference in advancing to the final eight and especially to the final four. So I understand what he was doing, but at the same time, he has set a precedent. And we know that drivers don't forget things. And we've seen it. We saw it in July, Kurt Busch talking about it during the rain delay that ultimately cost him the win down at Daytona, that they took one of those away from him in 2014 down there. They remember those kind of things. Guys will remember stuff for years. They may exact revenge before the end of the season. It may be 3 or 4 years from now, and Joey's running for a championship, and somebody roughs him up, and they ask him about it, and they'll be like, there was this time at Dover, and it's, you know, and he was racing everybody hard. It wasn't just Hamlin. He raced everybody hard, and I think part of that comes from when he started. You know, he got foisted into this deal when Tony Stewart left Joe Gibbs, and he wasn't ready for Cup. Joey will tell you that himself, and he was a kid, and a lot of guys roughed him up and took advantage of him, and I think that formed and established the way he drives. And he's one of the hardest driving, hardest guys to pass out there. And he pulls no punches about it. He'll tell you that himself, that this is racing. This isn't some kind of a beauty pageant or something. You're out there to beat the guy that you're running against. So he chose to race that way. But I worry for him that sometime down the line, it may not be this year, it may not be next year, but sometime there's going to come a chance when he wants to be able to get by people, and they are not going to let him because of the way he raced this weekend.
Yeah, and it's not just this weekend. I mean, we've seen, like you said, Joey's notoriously known for racing people hard, and that's how he wants to be raced. Yep. You know, you think of like the Kenseth incident, or even last year, Martinsville, him and Truex. Truex says, you know, he ain't going to win the championship. Well, guess what happened? Logano ended up winning the championship. Yeah. So, you know, Joey's, he's one of the, you know, he's very talented. He's probably one of the best drivers in the Cup Series right now. Yeah, obviously the defending champion. So, you're right. When you said precedent, he did set a precedent because what comes around goes around. And Denny Hamlin pretty much said that after the race to myself and a few other media members when he's like, you know, what did Joey gain out of this? He didn't really gain anything. He said he gained nothing, in fact. You know, racing 25 laps down or however many laps down he was at the time. And he just got a lot of people mad and they're going to race him really, really hard and pissed off a lot of drivers for no reason. So I don't know. It's never really, like you said, Logano got taken advantage of, I would say, at the beginning because he wasn't ready for Cup. But if you look at the past, I don't know, 5 years, the only time I think it's really bitten him is the Kenseth deal in 2015 for racing extremely hard.
Well, but at the same time, I think it's good that he has established this precedent.
Right.
You know, yes, it's going to bite him at some time. I promise it will. But at the same time, in the future, somebody that goes up to race him head-to-head for a championship or for a race win knows what to expect. And if he rubs them and bangs them and does whatever he has to stay in front, it's not going to be out of character. You know, if you're at Phoenix before we go to Homestead and Joey is racing to try to get to the final four and is, you know, and has to get by somebody, he's going to do it. He's going to use them up to do it. You're not going to be surprised at that. At the same time, if you see Martin Truex do it, you're going to be shocked because that's not how Martin races. And that opportunity, I guess, opens a door or two that wouldn't be open for Martin because people know you're going to rough him up. And if you do, it may make him mad, but at the same time, they're going to say that's the way he races. And they're going to understand it where if you've got somebody like Martin and you go in expecting them to not rough you up and they do, that's out of character and that can really catch you off guard. So at least he's letting everybody know that no matter what happens, he's going to race you as hard as he possibly can, even if he's 22 laps down.
Yeah, that's a good point. And Denny brought up the, not the incident, but I guess the last couple laps in New Hampshire with him and Harvick. And he says it's all about with, you know, the deposits and withdrawals that he mentioned back then. And that's how you want to be raced. Denny, you know, he gave Harvick one shot at New Hampshire, a little bump into turn one. And then Harvick kind of gave it to him and turned right off of four, making sure Hamlin wouldn't get by. But Hamlin could have wrecked him. He had the better car and didn't. So, you know, it's not that Joey, you know, wrecked anyone or anything. But when you're 25 laps down, I guess give more respect to the leaders, but Joey straight up said, you know, he treated this as a normal race. Once he got out on the track, he treated it as a normal race. They went, you know, business as usual, even though they're so many laps behind. So I guess you can't fault him for that, for racing like that, although he should expect it and does expect it in return.
Yeah, like I said, I understand it, and I guess I respect it, but man, it's he knows what he's going to get going forward. And that's going to be, it's going to make life a little tougher than it really has to be for him.
Of course. Now, Neff, there was a couple other drivers that had mechanical failures in the playoffs. We can go with Chase Elliott since his happened at, you know, in the first 10 laps on lap 8. He blew an engine. I'm curious as if he missed a shift on the restart or something, because that's very early into a race to blow an engine.
Yeah. I mean, especially because you're using the same engines. I mean, they run them in qualifying and stuff, too. You feel like there had to be something, whether they didn't fill a fluid level properly or they had something didn't get done in pre-race or whatever that caused that failure. Because it would be, I mean, it'd be possible, maybe surprising to have it be just a part failure at that point in time without extenuating circumstances. So I'm with you. I feel like he did something, missing a shift or whatever, that over-revved the engine, and that was ultimately what cost him. But, yeah, truly shocking to see a Hendrick engine give up 10 laps into a race. That just doesn't happen hardly ever.
Yeah, and I brought up the missed shift aspect because, you know, late in the race, that was probably 100 to go or so, Denny Hamlin said, "For sure I'm blowing up." Something to that effect.
Yeah, that was really weird.
So the reason he said that is because on the stage to restart is he over-revved the engine and missed a shift. Now, I don't think that was confirmed in the broadcast, but post-race he clarified that and said it was just his mistake and he thought, you know, he blew it up. But that's why I'm thinking the Chase might have missed a shift. But like you said, the fluid levels might not have been high enough. Anything could have happened. But you don't really see a Hendrick engine blow, especially that early into a race. Right. And then the other, and you know, he had a lot, he's 7 points back now, and we're going to Talladega, which he won, last in the spring, and he won Kansas last year. So he's definitely not out of this by any means, but he was the defending winner of the Dover race. He had a, looked like he had a top five car in practice and qualified fifth. So it is a little bit disappointing for Chase for sure to be out so early. But Neff, another driver had a mechanical failure late, was Ryan Blaney. He reported no brakes. And when you're going that fast at Dover, you want to have a little bit of brakes.
A little bit or a lot. it's especially with pit road there. And I know we hear this every week about how hard it is to get on pit road. And you think maybe we could design pit roads that aren't hard to get onto. But at Dover, it is incredibly difficult to get on. Ask Matt Kenseth about it. I believe he ended up on top of some tires there 1 year. So, it was a big deal. And I was actually impressed with Blaney being able to stop in his box without any brakes. But they were explaining on the broadcast that you can actually turn the car off in gear and it'll stop pretty quick, which is a true statement. So it was well done by him to get it stopped for the team, but it was interesting because the way they were running there, I don't know that you were using a lot of brake. So it was kind of odd to have a brake failure there. But you definitely need to have them for pit stop purposes, if nothing else. So that was a big deal. And again, I mentioned earlier about Penske really needing to get together at Talladega. This is yet another reason. They, as a team, they have just not been hitting on all cylinders for a while now. And it's critical that they have a good Talladega and that one of those three win it to make sure they at least get one car into the final eight. And right now, you don't know. So the pressure is going to be on for the flagship team of the Blue Oval for sure when we get to Talladega.
Yeah, for sure. And watching the race from the press box, it was interesting because the left rear started to smoke on Blaney for a few laps before he reported no brakes. So I made note of that on Twitter, and then ultimately, you know, they go on television and they say that they have no brakes, and that's what they reported, and on his radio that I was listening to. So it was interesting to see. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they went together. It's not a coincidence, but yeah, Blaney's 22 points out. I wouldn't say he's in a must win, especially with Talladega, but if he doesn't get stage points in the first two stages, he's probably going to be in a must-win either at Talladega or Kansas, I would imagine.
Yeah, I feel like the pressure is definitely ramping up for him to start already focusing on points racing even before we get to the last race of the segment, stage, whatever we call this, this vision of the playoffs.
Yeah, in my playoff, I mean, my pre-playoff grid, I had both Keselowski and Blaney out in this round. Blaney just hadn't shown the speed, really, in my opinion. You know, he's been flashy all year. He's never been that consistent. And that started off at the beginning of the year. I think he had 4 straight finishes outside the top, like, 20, and then 4 straight finishes inside the top 5. Like, it's been really an interesting year for that 12 team. But then Keselowski, you know, I would change that because I think he's performed better than Logano in these playoffs, but I think Logano makes it in too. So we'll have to see. We'll talk points here in a little bit. But Neff, Alex Bowman had a good run too. That's second straight top five. Finished third at Dover. Finished second at Dover in the spring. So it looks like he has kind of figured out the Monster Mile.
Yeah, he's either figured it out or he found Jimmy Johnson's notebook. because we all know that Johnson can get around Dover. But again, we know the pressure's on him. He performed at the Roval to get into this round, and it looks like that team looks like they're really, again, peaking at the right time. We've got some teams like Larson's that are just now, for whatever reason, really hitting their stride, and if you're going to do that, this is the time to do it. So it is, it's weird having Talladega, not weird, it's refreshing having Talladega at this spot in the playoffs, because some teams are coming, some teams are going, and the wild card that is Talladega could completely upset that apple cart, and it's going to be fun to watch.
Yeah, and if we talk about Blaney being inconsistent and flashy, so is Bowman. I mean, remember earlier in the year, he had three straight top fives, three straight second place finishes. Then, you know, he had like six top tens in a row. Then didn't get a top 10 until Chicago. Then didn't get a top 10 for like 2 months. And then now he's got back-to-back top fives again. So, you know, we're going to Talladega. He finished second there in the spring, just like he finished second at Talladega and Kansas and Dover in the spring, which were also all back-to-back races back then, too. So, yeah, the 88 team, it looks like they're kind of starting to turn the corner, because they were out to lunch there after their win at Chicago for the final 10 races of the regular season. So, yeah, I mean, hey, Greg Ives, he's kind of a mastermind in the pit box. If you look at the stats, if you dig way down, I've seen an article on The Athletic. So, good to see the 88 team kind of turn the corner, per se. And, hey, maybe they'll give it hell and be the last Hendrick car remaining.
I mean, you wouldn't expect that, but I wouldn't be surprised to see it at this point, because it seems like in the Hendrick camp, they're running as well as anybody.
For sure. Now, we made a note off air about Matty D. Another top 10, Neff. That's his seventh top 10 in the past 15 races since Sonoma. So since then, he's really been kind of a playoff caliber car for sure. And obviously in all those laps at Bristol, finishing second. But this is his seventh top 10 of the year, like I said. Neff, that matches Levine Family Racing's total top 10s in their first however many starts in the series. I think it was 199 I put on Twitter the other day. So he's got seven of their 14 top 10s in the last 16 races.
They've been running well. I know, or at least the understanding is that they've had maybe a little bit more help from Gibbs this year than they had in previous years. And, I mean, just as a team in general, having Wheeler on that box and having that whole team kind of be together for a little time, I think has really paid off. And I honestly feel like JGR would really like to give them a strong finish to the Matt DiBenedetto years. And so I feel like they're giving him some really quality stuff to run, and he's got the talent to get it there. So it's... We love us the D, and we are happy that he's showing out well. We're really happy that he's already got a great place to be next year. But I can't even fathom how amazing it would be to have him get a win at just the overall insanity that would be social media and the celebration if he was able to get a victory. Because that's, I mean, you talk about a fan favorite, he is right up there.
Yeah, for sure. I was standing by the intro stage for driver intros on Sunday, and I would say he was in the top three or four of biggest reactions, and that's Dover. So, I mean, it would be huge for him to get a win, and I definitely think he will next year. Like I said, I called that I predict he'd win the 500 next year, next February, when it was announced he's going to the 21, the 100th win for the Wood Brothers, unless Paul Menard gets it this weekend at Talladega. But I'm going to go with Matty D to still, you know, win that 500 here in a couple months, you know, obviously not done with this year yet, but, I would imagine he's looking forward to next year quite a bit, getting into that Team Penske camp per se. And, you know, we talked about this a lot, but it's so cool to see the progression of his career, because you don't see it the old school way much anymore. You usually just buy a ride, and he hasn't done that at all. So, you know, Barstool Sports is going to be on his card this week, and I know Dave Portnoy, the owner, the president of Barstool Sports, is going to be there. So that would be a huge win, and they'd probably burn Talladega down.
They very well might. I mean, I was reminded of it this weekend because I was in Martinsville for the big late model race, and that was one of the times that that Matt almost won that race. The I think it was the first year that I went to it, and got wrecked coming out of four on the last lap, along with about a dozen other cars. And, you know, he just, that was one of the first times I'd ever seen him race, and was just impressed and followed him since then. And he's just a cool, down-to-earth dude from a really great family. And, I mean, it just, like you said, doing it the old school way, worked out from the late model ranks and clawed his way up, and has done everything, I think, the right way. And hopefully the racing gods are going to reward him at some point in time with the ultimate prize of a win at the cup level.
Yeah, for sure. Fun fact, I saw Matt DiBenedetto at dinner on Saturday night. We went to the same place in Dover. So shout out to the Green Turtle. No, we went to the Green Turtle. It's a nice little sports bar in downtown Dover. So good food, and it was cool to see other people, a lot of people within the NASCAR community there.
I had heard that our boy Harmon was fired up with John Hunter Nemechek to a point where we almost had another scrap at an Applebee's this weekend.
Yeah, Harmon talked to, I think it was Mike Finley of a friend of, you know, our colleague at Front Stretch, and he didn't say much. But John Hunter Nemechek did. You know, we're talking about a lap 21 incident in the Xfinity race when John Hunter straight up turned Mike Harmon, and I don't know if you saw the replay, Neff, but John Hunter didn't see the replay at the time. He spoke after the race about it, and he said, lap traffic in the way. You know, he came up, then he went back down, and he came across my nose. Personally, I didn't see that at all. I just saw him wreck him. So, I don't know. But, yeah, that was interesting. We didn't go to Applebee's, though I have been to Applebee's in Dover before. But that's for another day. Neff, I want to talk a little bit about the playoff grid here, because we're going to Talladega, obviously. Yeah, and Larson's through. He doesn't have to worry about it. Truex is plus 63, so he's, you know, he's got to really have a catastrophe, like I said earlier, which, I mean, that could happen at Talladega. But like I said, I would expect him, Denny Hamlin, and Kyle Busch to maybe lean out in the back, especially because, I mean, Toyota's outnumbered severely at Talladega when it comes to the manufacturer alliance. But then you got Kevin Harvick, who's fourth, and he's only 42 to the good, which is still comfortable. But then from sixth down, I mean, it's pretty tight. You have Keselowski plus 20, Bowman plus 17, and then Logano, Byron tied, Bowyer minus 4, Elliott minus 7, Blaney minus 22. So between 8th and 11th is real close, and only one of them will make it, potentially.
Yeah, and that's where it gets interesting. You're looking at Logano as really good at plate tracks. Again, I feel like you're going to see those Penske 3 team up together and try to get to the front and stay at the front as much as they can. And you never want to see team orders. You know, you hopefully they'll race it out at the end, but it would make the most sense if they can get it in the position to let Blaney grab the win, because the other two would get solid point days, which should get them really close to being locked, or at least Keselowski close to being locked, and, you know, Logano into a positive position going into Kansas, and that would get Blaney through, so you'd end up having all three of them come through. But it's Talladega.
Yeah.
I mean, put them in a blender and see what spits out the other side. You may have Bowman grabbing the win. It would be interesting to see Kyle Busch get the win after several years ago when he was the odds-on favorite to win the title, and he got taken out by riding, as you said, in the back.
Right.
Wasn't even in the draft. Was out of the draft behind the pack, and the wreck happened, and Austin Dillon ended up hitting him and taking out his chance to advance. So there's no safe place besides the lead at Talladega. We've even seen the leader cause enough accidents before. So it's why we love Talladega. It is crazy racing. And the one thing we can say, we bash this package a lot, but the one thing we can say about this package is that Daytona and Talladega, it puts on a show. Yeah. So we are going to get a show this weekend, and we're excited to see it. But yeah, it's when you look at the grid as you just went down through it, you realize how almost locked in it already is. I mean, your top six are pretty much advancing. And so you don't have much of anything to earn your way into. And that's why playoff points are incredibly important, and racking those up during the season makes your life in the playoffs a heck of a lot easier.
Yeah, I would say top five for sure. Only because Keselowski's 6, 20 points to the good. That's not safe going to Talladega, even though he is he's won there 5 times. He's a solid plate driver, but he hasn't had much luck on them in the past couple of years, especially at Daytona. So it'll be interesting to watch what Penske can do. You said, you know, maybe they could give the win to Blaney. I don't see that happening. Because especially,
I mean, I don't either, but it would be the smart play.
Right. Unless you have a mechanical. I mean, if there's a win there, you got to go for it, obviously. So, in Logano's, I mean, I would say him and Keselowski are probably the two best speedway drivers right now in the Cup Series. And Blaney's pretty good, too. He's not too shabby. Penske's got a really stellar lineup there at the Super Speedways. And maybe they can orchestrate something like last year with Stuart Haas. Although they did have 4 teams, none of them were selfish, and they ended up pulling. I mean, had there not been a late caution, they would have won the race by like 10 seconds, yeah. which is crazy for 4 cars to get away like that at a super speedway. But maybe they can orchestrate something like that. Probably not, though, because it seems like it's not an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth anymore. It's just you guys all got to have a plan. And, you know, the higher ups at Ford sit you down, as we've talked about, I think after the Daytona race earlier this year, maybe even Talladega. And they're like, this is going to happen. You got to make sure you look out for one another. So I don't know enough. It'll be interesting race weekend for sure, because I don't know what kind of race we're going to see. I would expect it's going to be a pretty entertaining one, like Talladega in the spring, and also Daytona in July.
You don't know. I mean, again, that's why this is interesting. It could be a follow the leader parade for 140 laps, and then it gets insane at the very end. Or it could be a 3-wide mobile parking lot for the entire race with guys coming and going. And that's, again, the beauty of Talladega and how this thing evolves. They're so organic. And sometimes it just takes something crazy right at the beginning of the race to kind of flip the switch and have everybody drive nuts. Or the opposite, where everybody just settles in and nothing flips a switch and they just drive around for most of the day. So I'm curious. I'm hoping we have pandemonium, just because that gives us a lot more to talk about.
For sure. My prediction is I think 2 of the drivers currently outside will be inside by the end of Talladega, because it's so close there at the bubble. But Neff, I do want to talk quickly about the Xfinity race at Dover, because similar to Cup, it wasn't the most entertaining race, although the first couple laps were pretty interesting, wild, I should say. You had Harrison Burton get loose off of turn 2 on the first lap. You had three cars get loose. Tyler Reddick hit the wall, Christopher Bell hit the wall, and Brandon, who was the third one? There's Noah Gragson hit the wall. They all hit the wall running 2nd, 4th, and 6th on the outside. So it almost looked like there was something on the track for them to all get loose, hit the wall. But ultimately, Harrison Burton got real sideways, spun in front of Brandon Jones, which eliminated him from the playoffs because it busted his radiator. Like I said, there was that John Hunter wreck with Mike Harmon just 20 laps later. And then really the rest of the race, there wasn't all that much. So it was very similar to the Cup race, in my opinion. Cole Custer took advantage of a late race caution through a cycle of green flag pit stops and got his 7th win of the year. That team, I mean, I feel like he's going overlooked, because there's so much talk about Bell and Reddick. And I've said it for months now. I think Custer's the championship favorite.
Oh, as long as he makes it to Homestead, absolutely. He is an absolute stud at Homestead. And he's strong enough to win his way in. I don't think he has to worry about pointing his way in. I mean, yes, he's underlooked compared to the others, but once he gets to Homestead, I feel like he'll be a favorite, just because he's that good there. Although there's no way to count out Christopher Bell ever, because he's proven with his road racing skills now as equal to everything else that he's got, that he can win on any racetrack at any time. So it assuming the two of them get to Homestead, which seems like it's not that big of an assumption, I think it comes down to in all honesty, with the way racing is right now, it's going to be which pit crew performs the best at Homestead that determines the champ.
Sure. And also over the weekend, I heard that it's likely or maybe probable that Custer remains in Xfinity for another year, just because there's no spot for him in Cup right now. They want him to stay in-house at SHR. So I would say that's kind of a bummer for him because he's proven he's ready for Cup.
Yeah. I mean, I would agree with that. I think he's as deserving as anybody right now of a Cup ride. But you got to remember that his grandpa's paying the bills, and I don't blame grandpa for being a little selfish and not wanting to let him go anywhere else because he wants him in his cars. If I'm Clint Bowyer, that makes me breathe a sigh of relief because I really feel like Bowyer was one in the greatest peril of losing his ride over there at the end of this season. So if that is the statement and they're going to leave Custer in Xfinity for another year, then if I'm Clint Bowyer, I'm having an extra beer this weekend.
Now, Neff, after this race, it was an elimination race. So you had John Hunter Nemechek, Justin Haley, Ryan Sieg, and Brandon Jones all eliminated from the playoffs. I don't think there's any big surprises there. Maybe Haley. I wouldn't say it's a big surprise, but maybe, I guess a little surprising because he has run consistent all year.
I was a little more surprised at Sieg. For what it's worth, I feel like Ryan Sieg is the Ryan Newman of the Xfinity Series. He runs just where he needs to get the quality points, finishes, and advance. And unfortunately, they had an incident or two that kind of damaged that a little bit coming through this round. And, you know, the failure at Charlotte was a big deal. Had they been able to finish, you know, in his normal, you know, 12th to 17th spot, then I think it's a different story. But unfortunately, they did have the issue, and it's basically knocked them out. So I didn't necessarily think they would make the final four, but I thought they would be final eight with a shot at final four on points just because of, again, they get it done, usually don't shoot themselves in the foot, and unfortunately just had that failure at Charlotte that ended up costing them.
Yeah, and I mean, they got off to such a hot start this year. We talked about them a lot, and then they just kind of were out to lunch, just kind of riding around. Didn't get many top tens throughout the summer, and then did pick it up right before the playoffs again. And then, yeah, had a not a great first round. He did finish 10th here at Dover, but not good enough to get to the next round of the playoffs. Like I said, no big surprises. The four, I mean, really, I would say it's Cindric, Allgaier, Briscoe for that last spot. And you want to talk about tight. Cindric is fourth in points right now. Gragson is eighth, and they're separated by 12 points. So
nice.
And you got Bell, who's plus 48. I mean, that's pretty stout. But last year, he's in a similar position going into Kansas next weekend. Obviously, we won't break down that race yet. And then Custer's plus 36 and Reddick plus 30. So they're all sitting pretty comfortably. But as we saw last year, Bell racked out of the first two races and had to win at Phoenix. So nothing's a guarantee when it comes to all NASCAR, but specifically the Xfinity Series.
Truth.
All right, Neff. So we're going to Talladega. Well, first, you got anything else on the weekend that was at Dover?
The weekend that was at Dover, no, not really. I mean, it was pretty much god-awful racing. And I know that we're continually told this is what NASCAR wants, but, man, I hope they pay attention and realize it's not what fans want.
Well, you did go to the Martinsville late model race, so why don't you talk about that for a few minutes, because this week on the Dale Jr. Download, not only was Bubba Wallace on it, which is stellar audio that people should listen to, but so was the race winner Josh Berry, who led every single lap of this race.
Yeah, I was going to throw something in at the end, but now it's fine. I mean, if you've never been to the late model race at Martinsville, you have to go. It's a bucket list item because it's the Super Bowl. You know, that's an overused term, but it's a Super Bowl for local short track late model racing. And that late model I refer to is a perimeter late model, which is the NASCAR late model, which is predominantly raced in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, and Tennessee. It's kind of the home of that type of late model. They also run in the Southwest, out in California and Arizona and out that way. But this race attracts the best of the best for the most part. There's a few guys that took off this year, most notably Philip Morris, who was in contention for the national championship for much of the year. But he had decided early this year that he really wasn't going to go to Martinsville. He had his opinions and beliefs that they were trying to hand the race to one or two people, and so he didn't want to play by those rules. I think we'll see what happens next year. But they had changed the format a bit this year, and there had always been a late race caution with an invert or without an invert to really try and mix things up and add excitement to the race. And the only real excitement it added to was for SRI and AR and Five Star Bodies getting to sell a lot more parts, because the end of these races were just demolition derbies and guys' cars were just getting destroyed. So this year they did no invert, they did no late race caution, and let it just play out organically. And your end result was that Josh Berry showed up with a car that was ridiculously good. And we've seen it in the past once or twice at Martinsville. Philip Morris had a car that I've bragged about before that I've never seen a car that dominant at any racetrack. He was out just going to run away with the thing and had a fuel pickup problem. So they came in, they worked on it, and he went like 7 laps down, got back on the track, had to start back in the field on a restart, drove through the field, unlapped himself once, went all the way around and drove back through the field again and was almost ready to get his next lap back when a caution flew. And then he had the fuel pickup problem again and basically dropped out of the race. But had that car not had the fuel pickup problem, he'd have won that race by multiple laps. And and you're talking about a race where in qualifying, the top 50 cars are separated by maybe 2.5 or 3/10 of a second. I mean, the difference in qualifying is insane. But the race itself, outside of Josh just dominating it, was fantastic. And at the end of the race, the last 25 or 30 laps, you had Timothy Peters, former truck driver, and Lee Pulliam, 4-time national champ, who has won this race twice, battling it out for second place. And, I mean, side by side, trading paint, rubbing fenders, but really clean about it. I mean, after the race, they were both, you know, complimentary of the other guy, that they really enjoyed the race and didn't think anybody did anything wrong. But it was, that racing was fantastic to watch. Bubba Pollard made a one-off start with Junior Motorsports and made a bad decision on adjustments at the first break that they had and had to kind of rebound from that and get those adjustments reversed. So he ended up having to come from pretty deep back in the field with a 5th-place finish. But, the top 5 to 8 guys in his race could easily win a national championship in late models or in NASCAR. And, you know, there was somewhere in the neighborhood of 15,000 to 18,000 people probably at the track. And the winner gets a grandfather clock, which is just amazing for somebody at this level. And it used to be even cooler, to throw a little history of this thing out. Back in the day, Martinsville only gave clocks to guys that won on Sunday. So when you had Xfinity or trucks that would come and run on Saturdays, they got a trophy. They did not get a clock. And so back then, the only clocks awarded were for the 2 Cup races and for the late model race. So when you got a clock, it really meant something. Nowadays, they do give it for the truck winner, and they will give it for Xfinity when Xfinity comes and they're running modifieds too. But it's still pretty awesome to win a grandfather clock at Martinsville. And Josh got one. And the other cool thing that I love about Martinsville is Ridgeway delivers their clocks at the beginning of the season, and they keep them in a shed somewhere on property in their wooden crates. And when you win, they give it to you that day. So there's a picture on Twitter from early Sunday morning of the clock already in Josh Berry's house. I mean, you pack it in your hauler or you put it in your car and you take it home that night, which I just think is phenomenal. But yeah, that huge thanks to Clay Campbell and the gang at Martinsville for putting this event on year after year. It means so much to everybody in the local short track community in the Southeast. And it is a true bucket list item. If you get a chance to see it, it is definitely worth going because you see guys running for the love of the sport that put it all on the line, and you have heat races that set the back half of the field. So guys are doing everything they can to finish in the top 10 of the heat races to advance. And I mean, it's racing in its purest form, and you really need to enjoy it if you get a chance.
Sounds like that might have been the race of the weekend.
It was.
But yeah, so I don't know if you heard this, but apparently there's a deal that Josh Berry and his wife made that if he won the pole on every single lap and won the race, that he'd have to buy a Tahoe. And
see, she didn't tell me what the deal was. I was talking to Jenny in the media center afterwards, and kudos to them, or congrats to them. They're going to be having their first kid coming in late January, I believe. But she had told me that they had made a deal, but she wouldn't tell me what the deal was. So that is cool. But yeah, he won everything you could win. So you got a $5,000 check for winning a pole. They have two segment breaks. So you had, if you're leading at the segment breaks, you had $1,000 for each of those. You got $25 for every lap that you led. He led all 200 laps, so that's $5,000. So he's at $12,000 there, and then you get $32,000 for winning the race. So he cashed $44,000 at the end of the day. So if that's the deal, he's going to spend pretty much all of that to buy a Tahoe.
Sounds like a good night to be Josh Berry. Now, Neff, like I said, we're going to Talladega. We got two races. The truck is finally returned this weekend after 29 days off. It'll be when almost an entire month since Las Vegas to Talladega. And then we got the Cup Series, obviously. Let's start with the truck series. Neff, who you got winning?
You talk about a true crapshoot. I say let's just throw out something totally bizarre and go with Harrison Burton.
That'd be interesting. I feel like he needs a win. Because it hasn't been a great season for him or Todd Gilliland, as Kyle Busch has pointed out many of times.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go Johnny Sauter because, like Harrison, and though he made the playoffs, it hasn't been a great season for him either. And I would say he's one of the best super speedway drivers in NASCAR, not just the truck series. So I'll go Johnny Sauter.
Hey, one point more from Martinsville to give you an idea of what a big deal Bubba Pollard is getting in a late model. Johnny Sauter was supposed to drive that car, and when Bubba said he would do it, they booted Johnny out of the seat and gave it to Bubba.
And some of that's because Dale would have had to spend his own money for Johnny to be in the car.
That's how big Bubba is, though.
Sure. Now, Neff, the main event of the weekend, the Cup Series race, the second race in the round of 12. If you remember from about 6 weeks ago when we were breaking down the playoffs, my pick's already made, but I'll let you go first.
This is such a crapshoot. You don't know, but I'm going to talk about something that needs a good run and a guy that should have won it last year and lost it on fuel. Let's go with Kurt Busch to get the win.
Yeah, he dominated that race last year. I thought you were going to go with my pick for a second. I'm gonna have to fight you or something, because he was also in that Stuart Haas Racing Brigade last year. Clint Bowyer, like I said, I picked him right before the playoffs started. I said he was going to get to the round of 12, then get to the round of 8 by winning Talladega. And hey, he's in the round of 12, and he's only 4 points out. But a win at Talladega solves everything. So I got Clint Bowyer going to victory lane. And he almost won Daytona in the spring before there was a big crash. So, and he's won Talladega twice before.
Yep.
Neff, anything else before we sign off?
Just love it. Love playoffs. Enjoy this weekend because it'll probably be the last time we see really good racing in the Cup Series until I don't know when. So, because they're sticking with this package. So, enjoy it on these super speedways because that's where this package shines the most.
Sure. And Now, if we got Austin Dillon coming up on the podcast, talked to him at Dover over the weekend. It's obviously been a frustrating year for him. They've had a lot of speed, won three poles, almost won the Daytona race in July. Remember, it was him and Boyer. I said Boyer almost won it, but it was those two that kind of caused the big one there that the race ultimately never got restarted because of the lightning and the rain. But, yeah, we got Austin Dillon, Neff. Like I said, frustrating year, but maybe he can turn around this weekend at Talladega.
We will find out for sure.
So let's get to my conversation with Austin Dillon. Austin, going into Dover, 22nd in points this year. I know it's not been the year you wanted, but how would you assess the season?
Well, you know, it's definitely not what we want. If you graded it, it wouldn't be where you'd want to be graded. But, you know, we've showed speed at certain times, not been able to finish off races, and just a lot of little bad mistakes throughout the year that kind of put us behind, and you know, wrecks and other things also that are part of that. We were trending in the right direction the first, I don't know, six, seven, eight races there in the top 15 in points where we wanted to be, and then had that streak of wrecks that really put us behind and a lot of 30th place finishes. So just had to kind of dig ourselves out of a hole from there, and just trying to, you know, be aggressive at certain times, and it backfires. So just want to finish the year strong with some good finishes, so we can kind of like go into next year and know that we can go out there and compete with what we got.
Yeah, and when you have that speed, because you do have, what, three poles this year?
Yeah.
And then you can't get the finishes, or something goes out of your control, or something happens. How frustrating is that?
It can be frustrating. You know, it's just you got to keep a positive attitude and try and figure out how to be better as a group and not make mistakes twice. So hopefully we've learned from our mistakes this year and can put ourselves in better positions for next year.
I think at Bristol you told me in a group of media that it's been the most frustrating year of your Cup career.
Yeah.
Have you had a similar year to this in any forms of racing?
I'd say the first year of my Cup career and this one, very similar. Just more so this year because we've had speed and not speed at certain places and not been able to get the good finishes. You know, first year was just we didn't have speed in a lot of places. But, you know, it's that's why it's frustrating not getting the end results.
So what do you do to get over the bad weekends?
Oh, man. I guess I started working out, you know. That was a big part of leading into that, is just, you know, trying to do everything I can as a person to get better and better.
So in life, you know, you mentioned you need to have a positive outlook. Are you a person that kind of focuses on the positive or dwells on the negatives?
I try not to dwell on negatives. You know, you got to erase all those as fast as you can. So the biggest thing is, you know, trying to find those positives as much as you can. When you're a competitive person, you know what's bad and what's good. So it's kind of hard to shield yourself from those things. So just trying to take what you can from any of that.
And how helpful has it been having Danny Stockman with you? Because obviously you guys have had a ton of success and a lot of years together.
You know, it's good. You know, he knows what I need as a person to be successful, and he's trying all he can to give it to me. And we've just, as a group, got to do a better job of finding that quicker in the weekends, I think, and we'll be in a better position next year.
What is it about you guys, though, you and him, that kind of find success? Because you've won two titles together, truck and Xfinity, and always seem to run pretty well.
I think it's the fire. You know, we both are very fiery personalities, and we hate to lose. Losing sucks, and that's the biggest thing we've leaned on, is just the competitiveness. We always think that we're still in a race, or always think that we can win races. We don't have doubt in that department.
Now, you said you picked up working out. I do want to talk about that, because I was watching your Instagram stories, I think, on Tuesday, and you posted that. It was a long story.
Yeah.
Is that something you just recently picked up, or have you always worked out? You seem like you've always been in pretty good shape.
I've always been in pretty good shape, but not really taken to the next level as far as that goes in the gym. I got a trainer for the first time, and that's been really helpful. It started about a month and a half ago, and just trying to find some gains in there physically, and trying to take any kind of pain out of my body going into these races. That you know, leading down to the end of the race, if you have any thought of something hurting or in the car, you just want to take it out so your body feels good, so you can give 110% the whole race. So I saw actually Tyler was the first one that was working out with the guy I've been starting to work out with, and kind of gravitated toward him, and felt like it was the right time to try it out, and just trying to get better and stronger.
This is kind of a company-wide thing, because I know I talked to Kaz a few months ago, and he said he was also working out a lot with RCR.
Yeah, Kaz is also one of those guys with Tyler that got in there, and I've seen both of them, saw gains in their body and what they look and feel. So just want to put myself in that same situation, and already tell the confidence is higher for me now just after working out. You know, working out does a lot more than just physically making you feel good. Mentally, it gets you right too.
How does it help you in the car, if at all?
I think, you know, just knowing I can manhandle the car for a longer period of time and not feel any pain or feel my knee or anything hurting ever a long period of time. Just getting that stuff around my body parts that are usually taking a lot of stress. And over a cup year, lots of laps, you start having the same injuries kind of come up longer end of the year, just from wear and tear of your body. So only way to kind of push that off, I think, is to get stronger in other areas that you're not usually doing. And some of the workouts that we do are targeted for those areas, and I've just never had strength in them because I've been in a race car so long in my life.
And I know Whitney obviously documents a lot of hers.
Yeah.
Why do you feel the need to document yours?
I wasn't planning on it, and one of the new employees at Team Dylan Management wanted to put it on our social media, and at first I was a little skeptical of it, and I was like, oh, let's just be open with people. I think they like to see that and show people what I'm doing, and hopefully they enjoy that.
Cool.
Hopefully they can see me progress over time too. I kind of wanted to do a progression. I have aspirations of getting my body in a bigger, better looking.
Now, a couple more for you, Austin. Over the last month of the year, what are some of the goals for you and the three team?
Finish strong. Don't let up. We want to hopefully gain as many points position as we can, and be consistent every weekend unloading at these tracks that we have for the finish off the year.
And we're heading to Talladega. You've obviously shown success on the Super Speedway, winning Daytona last year, almost winning Daytona this year in the July race. What's your mindset going into Talladega?
Well, you know, speedways are a good place for us. My grandfather's leading the flag. We'd love to get another pole and push him around the track and lead Chevy in that aspect of things. You know, we've got some speed. I felt like we gave one away a little bit at Daytona, and hopefully Talladega we have that same speed.
Cool. Now, I got a Twitter question. This is from at Finley Factor. What's the difference in attacking these tracks in the playoffs when you're in the playoffs compared to when you're not in the playoffs?
Yeah, it's really hard racing around other guys because they kind of take advantage of you, knowing that you don't want to take them out of the track. But, you know, a lot of people think, oh, you have an advantage because you're out of the playoffs. No, it's not that way. The thought process is a little different when those guys are out there. They're really aggressive, trying to get every point they can, and that's what they should be doing. And same for you. You're trying to just have good finishes for your partners and your team. So it's a little bit hard to balance. Don't think it's an advantage by any means. You want to be in the playoffs.
Cool, Austin. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
All right, y'all. There you have it. Fun conversation there with Austin Dillon, who, like we talked about, if you look at his Instagram stories recently, he's been really documenting his workout progression, which is cool to see. And he mentioned that that's kind of how he keeps his mind off of racing in that interview. I expect him to be a pretty big factor this weekend at Talladega, where he nearly won the July Daytona race after leading the most laps. And as you guys heard, Neff and I were pretty harsh on the Dover race this weekend, but rightfully so in my opinion. The current rules package doesn't seem to fit that track, as both races this season were a pretty bad show. We understand all races aren't going to be great, and you'll have a dud every so often, but when drivers that aren't always outspoken, like a Jimmy Johnson, ran about it on social media, maybe it's time to look into it. But that's all for this week's show. Until next week's show, where we review Talladega, and that should be a good one, we out.